Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our conversation this week is with Dan Curry, who really helped raise the bar for visual effects in episodic television. Before we get to that, I just want to mention that many of you have emailed us asking if we're going to be doing coverage or podcasts from NAB this year, much like we did last year, and the answer is a resounding yes. We've got a lot of things set up. We're going to be doing our roundtables, as we did last year. We'll continue to have interviews and discussions with manufacturers and people from key positions that we record on the show floor. And we'll also have coverage on Monday of the Autodesk user group meeting, which takes place on Sunday. All that and more, including things like the Apple announcements that are happening on Sunday, as well as Adobe. So look forward to that coming up at NAB. If you're not going to make it there, we'll try and bring it to you. Getting to our podcast for this week is with Dan Curry. And as I mentioned, Dan was a pioneer in doing high volume, really high quality visual effects in episodic television. He worked on the Star Trek series, such as Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and saw the transition from really one-inch video effects done in traditional ways to computer-generated effects. So we saw really an entire transition in the visual effects field in episodic television. And as you'll hear and read on our online story, that actually had a tremendous impact in film visual effects as well. In addition to Dan's talents in visual effects, he also has done an incredible amount of title designs for episodic television, as well as feature films. Things like, of course, Star Trek Generation, First Contact, and runs the gamut all the way to things like Fatal Attraction, Beverly Hills Cop 2, and Top Gun. So he has quite a breadth and depth of work on his resume. In addition to that, he's also just an incredibly talented natural artist doing painting, and also obviously that translate into his matte painting skills as well. And in our online story, if you check it out, you'll see some links to his imagery as well as links to his online gallery. So let's go ahead and join that conversation that Mike had with Dan. The conversation runs from talking about the Star Trek episodic television series, from the technical concerns to kind of fun behind-the-scenes stories, as well as covering some tips for getting the most out of your matte paintings for visual effects shot. Because, of course, Dan's background as a traditional painter really helped him examine light and then how to translate that onto both the small screen and the big screen.
Thanks, John. And thanks, Dan, for joining us. I must say it's a great pleasure for me to be sitting here talking to you.
Well, it's good to see you again.
In fact, last time I think I saw you, you were kind enough to show me around the set of Voyager, which was a great thrill. In fact, I even got to sit in Captain Janeway's chair, which I remember you pointing out was leaning slightly forward so she could jump up quickly and look dramatic. And
yeah, that was Kate's idea. She wanted it ergonomically designed for her acting needs, and anything that helps an actor is what should be supported.
Now, what I wanted to talk to you about today was looking back and hopefully a little bit forward on what you're up to. And in particular, I wanted to emphasize the amazing experience you've had in matte painting and visual effects. And, of course, along the way, I'm sure we'll touch on a bunch of stuff in Star Trek because you had such a long one. How long were you working with Trek?
18 years.
Wow. And so before that, though, you had a fine arts background, and I believe that you initially got started through matte painting. Is that correct?
That is correct. When I was in graduate school, I was at Humboldt State University in Northern California, and I was doing MFA programs in film and theater. And by an amazing coincidence, I was given a one-man show in one of the at this campus art galleries. And Marcia Lucas, who was married to George at the time, walked by the gallery and saw some of my paintings and approached me and said, "Oh, you should look into doing matte paintings." And she introduced me to Dennis Muren, who was very kind and gave me a lot of advice. And when I was done with grad school, I started at Universal Heartland doing matte paintings in oils with a lot of latent image or original negative compositing for Buck Rogers, Battlestar Galactica. We went on to the immortal Cheech and Chong's next movie.
They're the best movie, in my opinion.
The Incredible Shrinking Woman. And then after Universal, I went to Modern Film Effects Did some freelance work on between them on such films as Caveman with Ringo Starr. And at Modern Film, I did a lot of both title design work and visual effects, and then went from Modern to Cinema Research. And there I was vice president, director of creative services, and again did split my time between main title design and matte painting. Some of the main titles I did there were Top Gun, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, and Back to School was one of my favorites with Rodney Dangerfield. Then I was invited by Peter Lorretson at Paramount to come over and be one of the visual effects supervisors on Next Generation, and Rob Legato and I alternated episodes.
So, I mean, while I guess many of us would know you most from the work you did on the various series, you've also done an enormous amount of films, including a couple of the Trek films and, as you mentioned, other ones. Let's go back, though, to the early days when you first joined Next Generation, because I think one of the things that's most fascinating about Next Generation is it really was the precursor to what we now take for granted, which is high-volume episodic television visual effects. At a very high quality.
Yeah, I was really proud of the work that everybody did, and it should be emphasized that the work on Next Generation was a team effort, and there was a large number of people who were completely dedicated to both the idea of working on the show and what the show meant to the audience and to us. And for me, it was my first move from working purely in film to doing work in video, and we were using one-inch analog compositing techniques, and so I had to learn a new language, and the video editors we were working with, especially a man named Fred Raimondi, who's gone on to great things, and learn how to communicate with each other using language that we both understood, and it was terrific because computer animation wasn't really happening yet, so we had to devise ways to shoot things, and we would employ things like liquid nitrogen to create rifts in space with lots of lights. We came out with ways to do miniature fire by spilling liquid nitrogen down black velvet planes. Shooting miniatures, we sometimes would do 80-hour weeks just keeping up with the space shots required.
Because I mean, in those days, at the beginning of Next Gen, as opposed to by the time it finished, it really was almost analog video and analog special effects. And Next Gen pioneered the introduction through to sort of digital effects in the earliest sense of what we know it to be.
Yes. One of the big breakthroughs for us was the arrival of digital compositing, because it allowed us to, when we were working in 1-inch, we could only dupe a shot a couple of times before the image started being so degraded it was unacceptable. And when we went over to digital, we could dupe with impunity and really approach a shot in a very painterly way. And then we, as the demands of the scripts became greater and we needed huge fleets of ships, it became physically impossible to do that with miniatures anymore. And by that time, CG animation had evolved to the point that we were comfortable using it.
Now, let's talk about matte painting, because before we get into the digital stuff, you had experience and managed to work with many greats in matte painting, and of course your own work is has been spectacular. Can you discuss the approaches that you take with matte paintings? And you said that some of those approaches, before we started recording, you said some of those approaches are things you still do today.
I was blessed when I first joined Local 790, the Mad Artists Union. I was the 15th member. And in those days, you actually had to present a portfolio and were given an oral exam. And and I was also fortunate to have the opportunity to kind of work directly with people like Matthew Jurasich, and met Albert Whitlock and Peter Ellenshaw and Harrison Ellenshaw. And the big thing I learned from those masters was that film doesn't hold that much detail. And I was overpainting so that my early matte paintings looked like really nice miniatures. but they didn't look real. And what I learned, especially from Albert Whitlock and Sid Dutton and Bill Taylor, was that it's much more impressionistic. And if you forget the object, and because we don't see objects, all we see in reality is the light reflected off the object as it passes through the medium of air, unless we're in a vacuum of space. And if you focus on painting the air, and there's a lot less detail than you think, and it makes it more real. I remember seeing a painting by Albert Whitlock from Hello, Dolly! That had these amazing gold statues at the foot of a staircase. And when you look at them, look at the actual painting, that's just kind of a couple of strokes, almost like an impressionist painting. But when you look at it in the movie, it looks absolutely flawless. And if you actually blow up a frame of a piece of movie film to the size of a matte painting, there's not a lot of detail on there. It's very loose. So once I learned how to loosen up, it helped me do more realistic matte paintings. And even today, if I'm doing a shot in Photoshop, for example, I focus on depth of field and painting the air, and I'll even do layers of just pure sky color, sometimes with a gradient, and lay them between layers of objects in the painting. And then by controlling the opacity of it, I can create a good sense of verisimilitude of atmosphere.
So if I had like a light blue sky, I might actually get layers of light blue with a bit of a grad and then place them on a wide shot of buildings.
Or a full frame.
Right.
And so say if I have a distant horizon and a layer of mountains and a layer of buildings in the foreground, for example, I'd pop a layer of sky between each one of those with decreasing opacity.
Yeah, because I think there's quite a lot of attention given to perspective and matching up, but it's really the way that the light is just actually interacting that's really what our eye is going to, isn't it?
Yes, and another key factor is softness, because the air also acts as a diffusion filter. So a mistake that you see done by some inexperienced people or people learning is that they'll have a razor-sharp edge matte line but soft-focus stuff inside it. So the matte lines have to equal the focus of the object, the objects that you're depicting.
Yeah. I mean, some of these concepts actually go back a long way. I know the idea of reducing the color palette to less and less various colors is something that was done by Renaissance artists as part of the depth cueing.
Oh, they know all about it.
And yet, it's funny that we get this situation at the moment, I think, sometimes where there's sort of a digital collage effect that happens, putting everything in there because you have the opportunity these days of getting such high-resolution images. And really, that isn't producing a beautiful or necessarily real picture. It's just producing this sort of hyper-real thing that somehow screams visual effect. And
I've seen the kinds of shots that you describe, and I think it's just a matter of that artistic sensitivity to the experience. And I think a lot of people, I recommend when young people ask me about getting into the field, even if you have no intention of being a painter in traditional media, it's a good idea to go out and paint plein air outside. And just the fact that you're forced one stroke at a time to analyze what you're looking at, it's good to bring that back. So as you're doing a digital painting or digital composite, you bring that experience, that level of analysis that you don't get when you take a photograph with a camera.
And some of the other things that were happening around that time in Next Gen, you actually had to kind of be quite to improvise a lot.
Effectively. Oh, we did indeed.
Because I remember you talking at a conference once about some of the things that you had to do just to get there was something with pom-poms. Maybe you could
The force field around the Enterprise is a Mylar cheerleader's pom-pom. And I was in a fabric store, and I saw the stuff on the wall, and I picked it up and shook it, and it had a very nice random flicker about it. And we set it up set up a 45-degree angle mirror, and I shook it over it. And Gary Hutzel, who is now supervising the current version of Battlestar Galactica, shot it with 35-millimeter camera. And that was in many, many episodes of Next Generation. We used it for laser hits by throwing it out of focus. It was a nice galaxy. And it just that kind of organic randomness is what made it work.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the original series was obviously completely analog, but Next Generation was that lovely transition where we saw during the course of the program. In fact, there were two title sequences, weren't there? There was an initial title sequence, and then a couple of series in, that title sequence was updated.
Right. And then it was then updated a third time. There was a period where we did 3D letters, and then they decided to go back to 2D letters.
Right. And then during Next Generation's run, Deep Space Nine had its birth. Now, on Next Gen, you were working with, what, the Post Group and ImageG and...
That's correct.
CIS, is that right?
Right, and that was also true on Deep Space Nine.
And then who else? Was it Pacific Ocean Post that got involved around that time?
Right, and then Pacific Ocean Post did the 2D compositing, and I did the title sequence for Deep Space Nine, but Rob Legato oversaw Deep Space Nine, and then when Rob left to go to Digital Domain, then I took over both Deep Space Nine and Voyager.
It must be terribly satisfying for you in one sense to see what happened last September, October, when the miniatures from things like Deep Space Nine and Next Gen hit the Christie's auction, and just how much they were embraced by the fans and the spectacular prices that went for some of these miniatures.
Well, it showed how important to the global mythos Star Trek has become. And I think all of us felt a degree of satisfaction that at least these objects went into the hands of people that would cherish them and preserve them, and they weren't going to rot in some warehouse someplace.
In one sense, the risk has been diminished because I know in the fine art world there was a fire in one of the Saatchi warehouses, and we lost a lot of young British artists' work because they were all concentrated in the one place. And so in a certain sense, distributing the risk of these elements being looked after because they're now around the world. And in fact, that auction was astonishing. There was like millions of dollars raised, and some of the miniatures, and I think I'm right in saying this, that one of the original next-gen ships went for like $500,000, which is extraordinary.
I think the Enterprise D. There were several Enterprise Ds. There was the original one that was done at ILM that was 6 feet, and we phased out of that because the original concept was it had no surface detail and was intellectually interesting, but it didn't look big on screen. And because it was so large, it was very difficult to get mat passes because we'd have to do them in hookups, and to get a full mat pass of a flyby, we may have to move the mats two or three times, and it just ate up time. So by reducing it to 4 feet and raising the surface detail with plates and stuff like that, it looked better and it looked a little bit more aggressive.
Now, what were the passes that you would typically do on motion control to get, say, an Enterprise going by? I think you once said there were about seven passes.
There were seven passes. We would do a beauty pass, which meant the ship in the natural environment of its whatever light it would be illuminated by in space. Then we would do the matte pass, which would be to obtain its silhouette so we can put it into a background.
Now, would you normally shoot that against blue or green, or were there some passes that were done against fluoro red?
We started doing it against white card to get silhouettes, and it gave us different densities, and then Gary Hutzel came up with the brilliant idea to shoot it against day-glow orange with infrared light, which gave us a very even field of luminosity.
And quite a narrow bandwidth on the spectrum to lock onto that key for.
Yeah, and also it didn't matter so much what angle the card was to the light source, which white cards would be different luminosities, and it just made it very, very even. So
that was two passes.
Two passes. Then we have a warp drive, a deflector shield, windows.
The impulse drives?
Impulse drive and strobes.
Right. And strobes were what?
Strobes were like the little red and green lights and little blinkies that a ship at sea would have.
And I always thought that was particularly nice, that you'd have to look out the window of another passing spaceship to know which side was port and starboard and see the lights. Because there is that great thing about science fiction, isn't it, that you do need to have it still based a bit in the real world to have empathy with it, even though, of course, in some respects, you don't really need traveling lights on a spaceship.
Yeah, but I think it's the same as that we had the spaceship fly in some ways more like an airplane, which it wouldn't have to do in space because there's no air resistance or making the ships look sleek, but that we could rationalize by sooner or later they'd enter an atmosphere. But I always rationalized the flight systems as to make it intuitive for the pilot, that they would have learned flying on small planes in an atmosphere, and to keep that intuitiveness, and it just looked more dramatic and cool.
Moving to Enterprise, Enterprise did in fact land, I think, several times during the show.
And so did Voyager.
I meant Voyager, beg your pardon. That's what I meant, yes. And though once she landed under ice, which was slightly unfortunate, but a great shot. And tell me, by the time we got to Voyager, were we still on a miniature model, or we'd gone to digital?
Voyager started with a miniature model, and the title sequence has a mixture of miniature and CG work on it, and that we did with Santa Barbara Studios, and I'm especially proud of the Voyager title sequence.
I must say, I first saw that at a trade show. I think it was at NAB, and it hadn't aired in my country, and I was walking past a booth, and I literally ran into someone as I turned my head and just watched it, mesmerized. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. And that was, certainly in my humble opinion, just some of your finest work. The going across the asteroids of a Saturn-type planet and the reflection in the rocks, the attention to detail, how long did that take you to do?
It took us a long time. And again, that was an effort with myself. Dave Stipes helped me, helped us shoot the miniatures. Santa Barbara Studios was an important creative collaborator on that, and it was Emmy-nominated title sequence.
And, in fact, you've won many Emmys. You've were nominated, I think, how many times? Is it 15?
15 times, but won seven.
Seven, which is to say is astounding and greatly, you know, to be respected, because that represents a huge body of work. Tell me, on the Enterprise then, was that a digital by the time we got to the last series?
Yes, Enterprise was all digital. We did virtually no model work on Enterprise.
And yet, in some of the earlier shows, there were still digital models moving in, weren't there? Because I think by the end of Next Gen, even, there was digital. Was that right? I mean, like,
yeah,
there was,
and
there was a
phase. We started to get into it, and then Deep Space Nine, we used the physical model of Deep Space Nine throughout the entire series, with the exception of the very last shot scene of Deep Space Nine was a digital model. But we would mix digital models and physical models as needed.
Now, you also worked on a couple of the Trek features. Am I right in thinking it was Voyage Home and Generations?
That is, yes. And also I worked on Star Trek 4 and 5.
Right. Final Frontier being the...
4 and... 4 was the whales.
Yeah. And I always think of it that way as well.
Yeah.
5 was the god.
Right.
In fact, they've just announced that there'll be a 11th Trek feature.
Right, and it's my understanding that J.J. Abrams will be producing it, and I believe it's in good hands.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly it sounds interesting. The initial talk is that it'll be released end of 2007, 2008. But it is an odd number. Do you subscribe to the even-odd theory of Trek films? That
I do not. I'm not into numerology. I think J.J. Abrams, looking at his directing on Mission Impossible 3 and, you know, what he's done with Lost, should bring some really nice vision to the franchise. So I think it'll be great.
It'll be great to see the franchise once again producing new material, because it's been now a short while between the end of Enterprise. But that brings me to what you might be doing now. You've moved on from Trek. Can you give us a hint as to what you're up to?
Right now I'm working with Stargate Films in South Pasadena, and we are doing a pilot for Warner Brothers called Twilight.
And you're the visual effects supervisor on that?
That is correct.
So you're obviously keeping incredibly busy, but looking back on some of the stuff that you've done, some of it has obviously resonated at a personal level. I know that that you have got a very strong martial arts background that helped with some of the prop design.
Yeah, I one of the things that was made working on Star Trek a joy is that you weren't kept solely in your own department. And we had an episode in Next Gen where Worf was to have inherited a very special Klingon sword or bladed weapon. And the art department sent down a design that looked very much like a pirate's cutlass. And I had been imagining what became the Bat'leth for many years. So I said, yeah, how about if I come up with something? Okay, so I made a foam core version of it and went into Rick Berman and the other producers, and I made up a little martial arts kata, like a form, and showed its use. And in his inimitable style, Rick said, well, if you made it 4 inches shorter, it would be good.
And that was in fact building on the martial arts experience that you gained through Asia, because you have strong ties to sort of Asia. You've worked
right,
in the Peace Corps.
And after college, I went in the Peace Corps and built small dams and bridges along the Mekong River in Thailand, and then I worked in doing other work after that for different government agencies and doing independent work, and it was
Because I'm leading up to that horrible question that I know you're going to dread, but does that mean that Next Gen is kind of the fondest of your memories looking back? No,
I would say if you have four children, which one do you love more? And I think it's the same way. I think each of the series I worked on, I love differently for different reasons.
Well, I will finish up, but not before I've touched on your actual fine art work that is now available to be certainly viewed online. And can you tell us about your actual your fine art painting work, as it were, as opposed to the visual effects work?
Yeah, I think it's always been related to movies. When I was little, growing up in New York, I was doing storyboards before I knew what they were. I'd kind of draw scenes from imaginary movies, and just like movies can transport us into another time and place, so can fine arts. And the reason I've stayed passionate about fine arts and make time to do it is it's not a collaborative effort. I don't have to worry about the imagination of a producer or
studio. You don't have to make it 4 inches shorter.
Right. And so it just becomes something, a conversation with myself, and I've come to paint with sometimes my work is very surreal, sometimes it's very hyperreal, but even when I do kind of hyperreal stuff, the intellectual challenge for me is to do it without reference. So I paint solely from the imagination now.
Oh, that's interesting. And your work was featured in the VES book that came out a little while ago.
Right, Visage. And that was actually one day I was sitting at a membership meeting, and I looked around and I saw how many really great artists are members of VES, and I thought to myself, I wonder what the work they do for themselves is like the work I do for myself, and that don't have to be serving a story or something else. And so I suggested, why not do a book that features the personal work of these people who are known in other areas? And that's what Visage is all about.
Well, if it's all right with you, we'll put a link both to the book at the VES and also to your own personal work in the story. And thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank
it's
you.
Been a real pleasure.
I'd like to add one note, if that would be okay. One of my favorite shots, which is ultra low tech, was the last shot in Pure Luck, starring Danny Glover and Martin Short. And if you look at it, there's a scene of this couple drifting on a raft over a waterfall. And they were out of time and money, and the editor, the great Billy Weber, called me up and asked me, can you come up with something to make the last shot funnier? And so I looked at it, and they had a helicopter shot on a river, and I said, well, how about make it look like they're going to go over a waterfall? So they said, we have no money. So I looked at some stills and realized waterfalls look like little white spots, so I came up with powdered laundry soap and dumped it over an aluminum foil cliff, shot it at 186 frames a second, and comped it in. And the last note about Star Trek is I really want to emphasize how big a team effort it was and how many dedicated people it was. So when I talk about Star Trek, it's merely as a representative of a very large group of dedicated artists.
In fact, you were running two teams, weren't you? Like to do an episodic program like that, you actually almost had an A team and a B team, or a one and what do you call it?
Yeah, and so each Rob and I came up with that idea right on in Next Generation, where we realized it would be better for one team to be on stage while the other team's compositing, so that they can follow their own work rather than try to do everything. Try to do every episode, and we carried that on. And so when the peak of effort was when we were doing both Voyager and Deep Space Nine, so we had two teams on Voyager and two teams on Deep Space Nine.
It must be nice for you to see so many of those artists now working so at such senior levels in features and even in new episodic programs like Battlestar Galactica. A lot of your team has since gone on as well.
Oh, yeah. And, it was their talent and vision was and resourcefulness was clear all along. And it's really great to see everybody living long and prospering.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. And thanks, Dan, for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I know Mike and I have both been huge fans of your work over the years, so it was great to sit down and talk with you and get some really insights into the industry. As I mentioned in our intro, we have some online imagery of Dan's as well as links to his portfolio, so be sure to check that out. And until next week, for co-founders Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.